you're back from a recent trip to the Netherlands, and really, you've been dogging this story for a long time, haven't you? I mean, you really care about the vets out there that died, didn't you?
Well, that's right, and also met some of the current soldiers from the parachute regiment that were over there
okay.
at the commemoration of Arnhem. I think the first thing to say is, I mean, you know, I've been looking into this battle for quite a while because it's really an open goal, or an open wound, or, you know, maybe you could call it an open wound, because it was an absolute massacre of the, for those that don't know, in a nutshell, it was supposed to end the war by Christmas 1944. It was in the tail end of September 44, the liberation of Holland. It's all portrayed in the film A Bridge Too Far, with Robert Redford starring and Michael Caine and others. In the actual battle involved several hundred tanks, something like 400 or 500 tanks, and the idea was to drop paratroopers at the three main bridges, which was around Eindhoven area, one at Nijmegen and one at Arnhem. So a division of paratroops on each bridge, and then the idea from that point was to then bring the corps of tanks up the road and over the bridges. And so there was a lot of infantry involved. Obviously, you can't just drive tanks on their own. They've got to have their infantry support around them. And the whole operation, it was a bit uncharacteristic of Montgomery, because he was generally seen to be a very cautious guy. Now, this was a little bit less cautious and more adventurous. But remember, it's at a stage of the war where if it had been successful, it could have really brought the war to a speedy conclusion by sowing total chaos amongst the Germans. Because on the Western Front, the Germans were fighting the Brits and the Americans after D-Day. And what this would have done, if they'd have succeeded in getting the bridge at Arnhem too, would be to directly threaten the Ruhr, which is the heartland of German industry, so that, which obviously they need to produce tanks, ammunition, all that sort of thing for the war.
Right.
So this was a direct threat to the Nazi war machine. And so they would have had to bring lots of other troops from the Eastern Front fighting the Soviets, and down the southern part of the Western Front, fighting Patton and his army further south. And so it would have been an absolute masterstroke if it had come off. And the incredible thing about the battle, George, and this is portrayed to a certain extent in the film as well, is despite so many things going wrong for whatever reason, whether they're a form of sabotage or whether they're just accidents, it seemed as if it was destined to succeed, because the actual men on the ground, particularly, I must say, a big pat on the back for the 82nd Airborne Division
okay.
at Nijmegen, because despite the fact that in many ways they were being misdirected and diverted away from achieving their objectives by General Browning, who was browbeating General Gavin, who was the American general, but his boss was a Brit, called Browning, and he kept trying to steer him away from the main objective, obviously, which was the bridge and the city. Now, as anyone that has ever been involved in fighting knows, that the best place to defend is a built-up area. Instead of Nijmegen, the city, Browning diverted and actually ordered Gavin to forget about the city and go and take hold of some woods nearby. Now, I was privileged when I was over there, George, to go and have a look at these woods and see what was so special about them that Browning decided that he wanted to go there and not to the city, which was his main objective. And I can tell you, they're called the Grosbeak Heights, the woods, and there's nowhere on these Grosbeak Heights can you actually even see the city. So it was pointless. I mean, it was absolutely pointless, because Browning's argument was, look, you've got to go over to the Grosbeak Heights, because from there, the German troops, if they can take that high ground, will be able to shoot at us, anti-tank guns and artillery and all that sort of stuff in the city. So what he did by diverting the troops over there, Browning, the 82nd, is he basically lost their main objective. Now, they realised this, Gavin and his men, probably a day or so afterwards, that this could turn into a big disaster for the division.
Right.
And so they started to sort of countermand the orders from above. Now, the main reason, it seems, that Brownie wanted to go to the Grosbeak Heights, because it was right next to the German border, and he wanted to be the first British Allied officer to urinate on German soil. So it was his own prestige in appearing in newspapers, things like that, which diverted him from the main objective. Anyway, look, this is, in a way, the main event was at Nijmegen. It wasn't really at Arnhem. The fight took place, and eventually the Moffat Burries and Colonel Tucker and Gavin succeeded in very bravely doing an assault river crossing and gaining on the 20th, which was 3 days after the whole operation began. And just in the nick of time, they took the bridge with an incredibly brave action, which is basically paddling across with their rifle butts across the river to take the other side of the river. And, of course, in the face of machine gun fire. Now, Moffat Burries, who I spoke to a few years ago, he's actually the most amazing guy. If you can, I don't know if you can find out if he's still alive or not, George, but he actually led this assault river crossing with his I Company, lost half of his men getting across the river, and then they took the far end of the Nijmegen Bridge. The other thing he did, which I've discovered researching this just this time, is that his fellas, when they got to the bridge, the other side of the bridge at Nijmegen, that's the north side, away from the city, you know, towards Arnhem, he ordered his men, he said, look, quickly, get your penknives and cut those wires. He could see some wires dangling down. And it's now almost 100% certain that it was him and his men, Captain Moffat Burries, and the various men under him, that succeeded in stopping the bridge being blown up, because he says there was an eerie silence, yeah, when they got to the bridge. So that it's, you know, because we've been fighting for this bridge, and suddenly there's nothing happening. You know, what's going on? Well, I can tell you what was happening is the Germans had said to all their men, "Get well away from the bridge. We're about to blow it up."
Right.
That was why it was so quiet there. And that's why there were no Germans actually shooting at him, because they'd all been told to get well clear of the bridge. Anyway, so by going in there and cutting those wires, his men, possibly by just a matter of seconds, stopped that bridge being blown sky high.
So he's a
really amazing guy. So anyway, so once that happened, I mean, see, this would have been a total disaster for the operation. But what happened was, the bridge didn't blow up, and that meant that the British tanks could then start rumbling across. And as the tanks started rumbling across, that's when the German general, who survived the war and he was interviewed in the 1980s, he said, well, I then blew the bridge up, tried to blow it up, as I saw the tanks coming. And the timing is exact, because Moffat Burries says he saw the tanks coming too, just after he'd snipped the wires. And it was at that point they tried to blow the bridge. Anyway, so at this point, what you've got is you've got a corps of tanks. And this is how Moffat Burries, the captain who was there at the time, who I spoke to, he says, at that point, the entire force of the corps of tanks could have poured across and then gone up to Arnhem, literally, straight away. And he was prepared, and he said, my men were prepared to sit on the tanks, do the job of the infantry, clear out any small pockets of Germans that were in the way, and then they could get to them. And the whole battle would have been won. And the objective would have been reached that evening. You know, within about an hour, these Sherman tanks could have rumbled up to Arnhem. I mean, when I was over there, I did the journey myself, and, you know, in the car, it's about, well, I suppose about 15, 20 minutes in the car, going quite slowly. I mean, this isn't a long, fast road. This is just tootling along like I do. And so they could have been there really by about 8 o'clock, something like that, 9 o'clock maybe. But instead of that, they were told to stop. And this is the thing that I find so amazing about this battle, is the links to the Bilderberg conferences, because it was a massacre there.
Yeah.
Because these tanks didn't come, the British 1st Airborne at Arnhem were absolutely massacred. And I actually did a talk alongside a guy called Rob van der Zon, who was born in that area where the British troops were surrounded and massacred. And one of the things, George, I wasn't expecting, and I haven't really spoken to anyone else about this, but other people who were there said that during the 1950s and 60s, there were a lot of ghosts sighted and kids were seeing ghosts in the city, in the town.
Really?
Now, this is unquiet souls, you know, so this is ghosts of British soldiers who'd been killed.
I see.
And so what they did in the little village of Oosterbeek, which is on the outskirts of Arnhem, which is where this massacre happened, is that they had these little prayer groups that went around in the 1950s and the 1960s and into the 70s. Anyone they're saying they were being disturbed by these ghosts, they would sit around, they would talk to the ghost, if you want, in a prayerful fashion, and then they would say some prayers for them, and one by one the ghosts all disappeared, George. Right. But there were quite a few of them, and it's really because of the injustice done, I think, and the, you know, war is a bloody affair, but this was particularly appalling that the Allies themselves, the British commanders, did not come to save the Arnhem soldiers, the Oosterbeek soldiers. Instead, they sat in their tanks on the north side of Nijmegen Bridge, with Moffat Burrows banging his fists on the tank, saying, "What are you doing? Get down the road. Your troops are hurting down at Arnhem." And in fact, he even pulled a gun on Lord Carrington, who was in the lead tank in the Grenadier Guards coming across the bridge, and threatened him and said, "Go down the road now." And it's because of this inexplicable 18-hour delay, where the battle could have been won, and instead they waited, George, they waited at Nijmegen Bridge. This is the British armoured division, the Guards
Army. Oh my gosh.
Waiting for the British airborne division to finally be massacred and destroyed at Arnhem Bridge, the final people to be shot, and for them to run out of ammunition and surrender 17 hours later. 18 hours later, the tanks then started to move. So an hour after the wire came through on the radios that the British had surrendered at Arnhem, an hour after that, the British tanks started to move again.
Oh my
so,
God.
To me, it's an extremely suspicious set of circumstances, where you've got one part of the army under one command, with Browning, Horrocks, it was Dempsey, I think, and Montgomery, actually abandoning one of their divisions, and waiting just until an hour after the division is finished off before they carry on. Now, I mean, for a long time, people have talked about this battle as a mistake, you know, or as a terrible error. I think we're now seeing, in the light of the deals that which were done between the Nazis and the Allies at the end of the Second World War, in fact, the main deal was signed by the German industrialists in Strasbourg just about a month before this battle started, which was around the 20th of August 1944 in Strasbourg. This agreement called the Red House Meeting, the agreement was signed, which was the Nazi Flight Capital Agreement, which was set up by Martin Bormann, although he wasn't actually at the meeting, but all these industrialists, including the arms manufacturers, all signed up to this deal a month before. So what was happening was, from 20th of August 1944, all these deals were then being done with the Allies. So the higher ups, you know, we're talking about royalty in Britain, you know, the people around probably the Vice President Truman at the time, actually, were doing deals with them all. And Alan Dulles, people like this would have been involved, who was over in Switzerland at the time. So those deals were starting to be done. And one of those deals was really important to understand, was that the war was not going to end by Christmas 1944, definitely, because the Nazis needed time to get a lot of the technology that they developed out. Some of it was flown out, others was brought out by ships and submarines and things like that, but they needed this time, first of all, to consolidate all the assets that they got in Berlin, the stolen from all over Europe and Africa, of course, and Scandinavia. All these things were being then shipped out of Berlin, so that when the Russians turned up, there was nothing left, George. So that's why I think this battle was sabotage from the top. That's why they didn't go and rescue the troops fighting at Arnhem Bridge, John Frost. And I can even relate a story which was told to me when John Frost, the colonel who was at the bridge, 2nd Parachute Regiment at the bridge in, at the Arnhem Battle, actually shook his fist in the air at one of the commemorations and said, "Do you call that fighting? Do you call that fighting? You abandoned us. You left us." So he was really angry about
that. Oh, I guess
his men had been treated. So Rob van der Zon, who did this, he's the guy who was born, he lives in Oosterbeek, and he was born in the Hexen Kessel, the Witch's Cauldron, they call it, where for 9 days the British troops were surrounded. I mean, if you imagine it, George, when they dropped with the parachutes on the Sunday, the 17th of September 1944, around just near Arnhem, and they marched towards the bridge. That was their objective. They all went there hell for leather. Literally within an hour or so of them dropping, the Nazis had already got armour in and had formed a blocking line. So it's pretty obvious that they knew they were coming. This is another side of the battle. Absolutely obvious that they knew they were coming, because otherwise how on earth would they have been able to form a blocking line so fast in exactly the right place, knowing exactly what the air objective of these paratroopers were. So that's also become clear now, is that Prince Bernhard, we've mentioned a couple of people, haven't we? Mentioned Browning, mentioned Carrington, and Bernhard as well. So Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, he sent in a soldier that gave the game away a few days before the battle into the Ab there. So German intelligence knew exactly what was going on, and they pretended they didn't. They put out various cover stories. In the film, they talk about a glider that landed with the plans. Well, of course, you're not going to send the plans for the whole operation in with a glider, just precisely because, you know, it could easily be captured and it might crash or whatever. So, you know, there's so many aspects to it, but for me, one of the main ones, George, was hearing the stories from people actually in Oosterbeek itself who were brought up around there. And one of them is where the local people at the end of the war, because they'd had a terrible time, the Nazis really punished the local people there, and something like 50,000 Dutch died of starvation in that final winter of the war, the end of 1944, beginning of 1945. That a lot of them were put in prison camps, concentration camps, this kind of thing, because the Germans said that, well, you know, you were collaborating too much with the Brits when they were there. And so at the end of the war, what the local Dutch people did is they managed to get some small number of funds together in order to fund a small memorial that they wanted to do in Oosterbeek itself. And they were told by the Dutch government they couldn't. That the money had to go to a big memorial they were going to have up at the Hartenstein Hotel, which was the British headquarters. The only trouble is that this hotel stroke museum now, the actual Moore Memorial itself was this enormous obelisk. Now, Rob doesn't like the obelisk. He says it's an insult, really, that yes, it's okay to have a war memorial, but we don't need this kind of Egyptian obelisk. And he's looking into the statue on the top of the obelisk, and he believes, through his research, he believes it's actually a statue of the founding queen of Babylon, who was actually a prostitute herself, who goes by the name of Semiramis. And he's looked at this statue, he's saying this is not a Christian thing. This woman is not there to sort of be the symbol of childcare and home or anything like that. She's the queen of Babylon, the queen of heaven, as she was called, and actually the statue itself is facing towards Babylon. He says, and this is his words, not mine, because I look at the military side of things, but it was interesting to see somebody from the local area saying actually he believes that this whole thing was a Babylonian style blood sacrifice, a human sacrifice done by the oligarchy, that is to say the top people on both sides of the Second World War, in Nazi Germany and in Britain particularly, and not necessarily so much in the US, but certainly the Brits, it was the British side in this battle that totally underperformed and totally failed to do what it was supposed to do. The Americans did everything they could to win it. And so I think that's a fascinating angle, and it was something I wasn't really expecting, George, to hear the local people. And they were saying as well that the other clue to this being a kind of Babylonian event is the way that nowadays the battle has turned into this kind of folk party celebration. Listen, man, this was a Nazi victory. And as he's pointed out, over the whole of Holland, of all of the battles that happened in World War II, this one, the commemoration every year is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. More money being spent on it, more extravaganza, more people coming. every year, and yet it's a Nazi victory.
I see, yeah. Well, they do these initiations and celebrations like that, don't they? Huh?
I think the clue is in the reaction of the locals for me, because I mean I didn't realize the extent to which it is getting bigger and bigger, the Arnhem commemoration, and also the fact that it's many aspects of it have stopped being a commemoration. They started to become a big kind of festival drinking party. Now is that appropriate?
No, it's not. It should be a solemn event. Memorial type event, right?
Well, that's right, and there are some. I mean, for example, I went to the service at the War Graves Cemetery there.
Okay.
Which was a solemn event. It was actually, they had a quaint old English village vicar came over, and they did a sort of joint service with a Dutch priest of some kind, and it was a beautiful solemn event. But the thing is, that's the exception. Most of the things that were going on there were like kind of concerts, so you got a kind of musical style depiction of it with big stage and lights and everything. You've got Hercules aircraft coming across with loads of paratroopers dropping out of them, and trumpets blowing and music going and all this kind of thing, and everybody basically getting drunk. So that is not appropriate, and I think this is a clue to the real aspect of this battle, which was actually a victory for the oligarchy. It was a victory for those who wished to profit from the Second World War, and if a few thousand British paratroopers died, then so be it.
Well, only 10 years later was that, what, first meeting of the Bilderberg at the Bilderberg Hotel?
Well, it was wonderful for me, George. I've never been to the Bilderberg Hotel before. And to actually visit the hotel with my Dutch friend Marco Verhey.
Okay.
He's from something called We Are Change Rotterdam. And what they do is they stick cameras in Dutch politicians' faces and ask them all sorts of awkward questions, like, who are you working for? This kind of thing.
Right.
And it was lovely that he showed me some footage on his camera that he just got the previous week, where it was the Dutch, I think it was the home, interior minister. And he actually said to this guy, as they always do, the first question they ask is, who are you working for? And this guy flat out said, I'm working for myself. Now, hang on, he's supposed to be the interior minister.
Yeah, gosh.
Working for himself. He's supposed to be working for the Dutch people, but he had no pretension of that. So anyway, it was lovely to be shown around by Marco, and he's done quite a lot of research on the Bilderbergs, obviously being Dutch himself. And one of the things he was surprised at, he said, I was here a few years ago, and it's changed. They've done a massive revamp of the Bilderberg Hotel, and in the foyer are four Bilderbergers. It's like, as you walk in there, you get the sort of...
a museum or for Bilderbergers, huh?
A bit like that. And of course, I said to one of the staff there, I said, well, look, here you've got is all these people are like, it's like, you know, an organized crime hotel.
Golly, Johnny, that's a good description.
and so the first person you get is Paul Rykens. He was one of the founders of Bilderberg.
Right.
And he was the chairman of Unilever. Unilever, of course, for many people that maybe don't know that much about Unilever, it's a massive company. A lot of the brands that it owns, you wouldn't even know they were Unilever brands. A lot of particularly food and washing powders, all these kinds of things. Half of what you see in the supermarket is Unilever, yeah? So they played both sides in World War II. So they had large organizations in Germany, Holland, Britain, and they were mainly Dutch-based, but they played a game very, very similar to the game that Royal Dutch Shell played and that the Rockefellers and Exxon play, which was, we will have a branch of our business on each side of the war, and whoever wins the war, that will be the branch which becomes the main branch after the war. But we are not going to lose this opportunity to make money from both sides of the war.
Right.
Unilever was the absolute classic company doing that. They also devised the helped the Germans. They were cooperating with the Germans, devising the system for an economic system for Nazi-occupied Europe. So they wanted to have basically a cartel system where all the big companies, basically like gangs, like gangsters, just divided up all the markets amongst their friends. And anybody like you or I, Jules, that wants to get in on that market, well, you're going to have to sing for your supper. That means you're going to have to get down on one knee to these guys if you want to even stand a chance of getting into the markets. So that was Paul Rykens. He was the first guy there. In the brand new entrance to the Bilderberg, on the left hand side as you come in, you've got a gigantic face of Henry Kissinger smiling at you.
Oh my gosh!
With a you know, it's a black and white photo, but the backlighting is white and it's really bright, so you can't miss it. And they're about sort of 10 times life size, so it's a gigantic head of Kissinger smiling at you. And the who's the next one along? Oh, David Rockefeller, that's right. The chap I met in the gardens of the Palace of Versailles
right.
in 2003 and had a chat with him. But obviously, David Rockefeller and the Rockefeller family are very important Bilderberg funders and also provided the sort of direction for many years for the group. And the final one is Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was the chairman for the first 20 years and one of the biggest crooks in the entire country of Holland. And also, of course, he wasn't even really Dutch. He married into the Dutch royal family. He was a Prussian aristocrat. Or maybe, I'm not sure if it was Prussia, it was certainly German. And he was also a Nazi. He was one of the first members of the Nazi Party, joined the NSDAP, the National Socialist Party. And he also joined the SS as well. So he was an officer in the SS. But then he decided to throw his uniform away and put on a crown and join the Dutch royal family in 1937, just 2 years before the outbreak of World War II. Then he chaired the Bilderberg meetings. So you've got a geographical in-joke going on, really. So when the Bilderbergers first started in 1954 in this hotel, what they were doing was saying, really, sticking two fingers up to the British that died there and saying, well, we're going to create a massive new Western lobby for the war effort, that is towards NATO and towards creating conflict with the Soviet Union, you know, the whole Cold War thing, and representing the arms companies, representing all the big businesses, and we're going to create it right in the middle of the place where one of the most audacious massacres of our own British troops happened. So that was, I think, the main reason why the Bilderberg meeting started there, is because it was signifying that they could do, these guys that had immense power, they could do whatever they wanted and they could get away with massacring thousands of British paratroopers just to keep their plans going, which were basically cooperations, treacherous cooperations, obviously. And this is why I called the talk that I did, The Traitors of Arnhem. Prince Bernhard was a traitor who betrayed the plan before the battle. Lord Carrington was a traitor who refused to go down the road between Nijmegen Bridge and Arnhem and rescue the British troops who were dying at Arnhem. Two enormous traitors. There were quite a few others too, but those were the two I found most interesting, because they then later went on to become chairman of the Bilderberg conferences. The Prince Bernhard from 1954 to 1975, when he was he had to leave because of the Lockheed scandal, which is where he was proven to have taken $1 million bribe from Lockheed to get them to buy Starfighter jets, I think it was, for the Dutch Air Force. And and Carrington, he was the, he went on to obviously become NATO Secretary General after being Defence Secretary under Margaret Thatcher. And then he became the Bilderberg Chairman for, I think, about 7 or 8 years in the 1990s. So you've got two key Bilderberg people who are both involved in failing to actually pursue that operation and ending up as being traitors back in September 1944.
Boy, that's interesting. Boy, you've dedicated a great deal of your time in getting this thing worked out and knowledge about this, haven't you, Tony?
Well, I have, and the reason is, George, is because it's like one of those gold seams of history. The more you look into it, the more you pick over it, the more you realise that this was a deliberate throwing of the battle by our own side, and that if there was any justice at the time, and of course, a lot of these facts have only have only emerged relatively recently. You know, we're talking about in the last 30, 40 years. I mean, some of the information has only been released under the Official Secrets Act fairly recently too, so you can actually put these pieces together. But actually, the main reason to for me to look into it is because what you've got here is absolute cast iron, solid evidence of a continuity of treachery against the people. So yes. You've got basically a bunch of scallywags. I mean, that's being a very nice way of putting it. I probably should be saying words that you can't say on the radio. These scallywags who've decided that the war is just a game. That if 6,000-7,000, 7,000 lost their lives in that battle, if 7,000 people have to die so that these specific individuals can, and their families into the future, can have privilege and wealth through organized crime after the war, then so be it. And the idea that you're actually fighting the Nazis becomes a sham. Or what you're really doing is you're secretly helping them from a high up position within the Allied camp. And of course, if there had been any justice at the time, almost certainly Carrington, and if not Carrington, his commanding officer or his commanding officer would have been court-martialed and possibly executed for what they didn't do or what they did wrong, you know. And particularly Bernhard sending this King Kong, this spy, into Eindhoven to betray the battle beforehand. He should have been put on trial instead. Yes. He had lavish offices at Scheif, Supreme Headquarters Allied Forces Europe in Brussels. He had a massive suite there where people were wandering in and wandering out, and he had virtually no security, so German agents could come and go as they pleased. I mean, this Supreme Headquarters Allied Forces Europe, Scheif Headquarters, which is where this battle, essentially the top levels of the command, people like Montgomery would have been there, were at, is what is now NATO, George. So those terrible decisions that were made to betray the plans, for example, to betray the plans by Bernhard, are now embodied in Scheif Headquarters in NATO in Brussels. And that is, I think, the continuity between those horrific events and the wasted lives of the young British men. Mostly it was the British men that were sacrificed in that battle. You know, and we're seeing the same sort of thing today. You know, we're seeing similar things. In fact, actually, there was an article out just a few days ago looking at, I think it was BuzzFeed News, who occasionally come out with some really good stuff. I mean, the investigations department at BuzzFeed News is really good. And sometimes it's skewed, sometimes it's rubbish, but occasionally it's brilliant. And this was just a confession made by a bunch of mercenaries, ex-US Army, most of them, who had said, well, we were running death squads all around the Middle East. And this wasn't terrorists we were killing. This was imams. This was peaceful political leaders, people who were looking for peace. And we were just executing them. And so this is the sort of thing that we've now got going on. It's almost a complete breakdown of international law, George.
Right. The mercenaries, in other words, it was like assassination plan. Is that our chaos creating or what?
That's absolutely right. I mean, we're talking about death squads, effectively. So they were given a specific individual, and then they would go in and murder them.
Right. What do you have on Jamal? You know, the recent death of
Khashoggi,
Jamal Khashoggi, there in the consulate in Istanbul. What's your thoughts there? And they've been coming out with just recent information now. The Saudis are saying it was an accident, fist fight, strangle, whatever. What do you think?
Well, first of all, George, I say, it's an incredibly audacious act. I mean, it's a terrible act. And I don't say audacious from any kind of positive point of view. To me, it shows just how utterly out of touch with any kind of human decency the Saudi royal family is, right? You can also see, can't you, what's going on. If you look at Mohammed bin Salman, you see, what that seems to me is happening is that the king is allowing the princes to run things, and then if something like this happens, that prince may be jettisoned. In other words, I don't think they would kill the guy, no. But what they might do is they might say, oh, well, he's had to done his time now, and they get somebody else to take over.
Yeah, that's one thing they're exploring now. There's a council that decides on the succession of the kingship.
Yeah, it's all a bit messy and medieval, isn't it?
Yeah, now what I see, the MIT of Turkey is like a combination of the CIA and NSA within Turkey, and they were listening inside that council that I believe. They have recordings. Now, what exactly happened, they've alluded to it through some leaking, and now the Saudis are coming back with some kind of an excuse that it was an accident, so many people are not believing that, see.
Well, the most recent I've heard is that the Saudis are saying that there was a fight.
Yes, that's absurd.
First of all, I don't believe a word of that. I mean, he said there was a bunch of people waiting for him. I mean, on the front page of the Daily Mail today here in the UK, we've got a picture of the guy who was, it looks, behind this death squad that was sent to Istanbul to the consulate.
Right.
And there he is shaking hands with Theresa May.
Right.
So, you know, in very much in bed with the British military and people like that. Now, I think what's happened is, yes, this guy has been executed in there.
Right.
In a particularly barbaric fashion, it seems, by the Saudis, psychopaths, is the only thing you can call them, really, taking pleasure from, I mean, they could have shot the guy, couldn't they?
Right.
They could have shot him in the head or shot him in the heart and he would have died instantly and they would have had their satisfaction. Disgusting though it is. But they didn't want to do that, apparently. They decided they wanted to cut his fingers off and then they wanted to slowly kill the guy. So he had a slow and painful death. And then cut his head off. You know, executed him by decapitating.
They wanted to disgrace him, to desecrate him. That's it. But in a Muslim way.
Okay, in Britain, King Henry VIII used to do this.
Yes.
Sort of thing,
okay.
In the 1530s, yeah? So, the abbot of Glastonbury Abbey, who stood up to the dissolution of the monasteries, he was treated in this sort of way.
I got you.
But in any kind of civilized country, you don't do that. First of all, generally, the death penalty is a bad idea because the person that you're killing may well have evidence which might be able to be used to convict other people, or maybe even to show that they're innocent in the future. So the state really shouldn't be killing people. It should be incarcerating them. And allowing, you know, potential further legal cases to come forward if that's necessary. But this to me is, it doesn't smack of any kind of justice. It's just a power crazed guy, Mohammed bin Salman, who the power has just gone to his head and he's decided I can kill in the most painful and horrific way anybody I feel like. I think he's been brought up, you know, with the idea that you're one of the most powerful people in the world. And that power has simply gone to his head. It's like he's got drunk on it. The only trouble is, of course, there's an important strategic alliance between the United States and Saudi Arabia, George. And I suppose the question now is, what kind of state is that alliance in?
Yeah, the president is very careful in describing his response to this so far, see? Because there's a lot of arms sales there, billions of dollars of money involved. And also, Saudi Arabia is an offset to Iran, see? In the area, so they're a big oil producer. So there's things to consider here. But
I think what we're seeing is immense hypocrisy, though, isn't it? I mean, you know, the idea that these people who can perform such a hideous act and it seems like get away with it. There's virtually no consequences for this. Now, imagine just for a minute. Imagine if the Russians had even tried to kill somebody. And then even fail to kill them.
Right.
Oh, hang on a minute. That's exactly what happened in Salisbury, isn't it? With the Skripal case. Oh, but the Russians didn't manage to kill them, but they did try, but they failed. What was the reaction to that? It was a mass expulsion of diplomats.
Right.
Right across the Western world. Now, what have we seen from Saudi Arabia? Any expulsion of a single diplomat for what is quite clearly and obviously the execution of one of the key journalists on the Washington Post. We've seen absolutely nothing. And he has been executed. Skripal and Julia Skripal and Sergei Skripal weren't executed, and yet there's been loads of, I think it's something like 30-something expulsions of diplomats as a result.
Right.
So what we're seeing now is it's absolutely clear just how hypocritical these Western
governments are. Well, here's what's happening right now is they're using a bunch of scapegoats over there in Saudi Arabia, but they're protecting the Crown Prince from being involved in this directly or personally. See what I mean? So they're arresting all of these different underlings and trying to stop it at that point. See what I mean?
I mean, I know it's grim, but I find it amusing, actually, George, to see the extent. I mean, it's taken them 2 weeks, over 2 weeks.
Yeah, then the second of the month, I think it occurred, October 2.
To come out with a even vaguely plausible lie. That's how pathetic they are. And I just think that anybody with half a brain cell can see right through this, George.
Yeah, there's theories that they're trying to affect regime change and knock the Crown Prince out as the succession of kingship there. So that's one of the thoughts there.
That might be no bad thing.
Well, the Turks.
The problem with Saudis is this. Well, I mean, some people call it a war in Yemen.
Yeah.
Of course, it's not a war; it's a massacre, and the British are very much involved. And this is something that we've seen occasional little hints at in the British press. Royal Air Force personnel over in Riyadh, helping to target the complete. Then there are no military targets left in Yemen.
Right.
Also, the main. Sponsors of this are the West. So this is a NATO Western battle against Yemen, which the Saudis are fronting. And it will be interesting to see if Mohammed bin Salman or any others of the Saudis actually start to talk the talk, say, well, actually, you know, the West has put us up to this, you know, this kind of thing. Although I'm not sure if it would actually be reported. But, you know, the other aspect to all of this is Khashoggi was working for the Washington Post. Now, we had 2.5 years, I think it was 3 years ago, a Iranian journalist who was working for Press TV in Turkey, who was executed by Turkish intelligence people, it looks like. Hardly a whisper in the press about that. And there she was, killed in front of loads of people who saw it happen, because she had been reporting on convoys which had been going down from Turkey in support of ISIS in Syria. And she was killed, but there was hardly a whisper about it in the media. I think the fact of the matter is, when it's one of these big major media organisations like the Washington Post, their journalists' lives account much, much more than the small journalists who, it doesn't seem, the mainstream press in the West really cares a hill of beans about, unless it's one of their people.
Well, you know, the Washington Post been CIA through Alan Dulles for years, and they're on the deep state side. And Jamal was on the Muslim Brotherhood side versus the Wahhabism of the Saudis, see. So there's a battle there also in the Middle East of those two factions.
Well, this is Mockingbird, isn't it?
Mockingbird was Alan Dulles. Actually, the Mockingbird thing preceded Alan Dulles' his directorship at the CIA, but it was right in there. He administered the Mockingbird also.
That's right. And so this is where we start to realize we do not have a free press apart from in
Austin. No, we don't. So we're talking about things that much of the public is just beginning to catch on to, but we've been looking at this for years, you and I, and we know that you can't believe anybody sometimes, you know what I mean? It's hard.
I think in a way that it's deliberate. A lot of this, I mean, they've thought long and hard about how to turn the mainstream press, the mass media, into a propaganda machine, because so many intelligent people get turned off of it, George. And what that means is that the most intelligent people in the country get turned off from following current affairs. Now, that's exactly what they want. They don't want intelligent people. They want the stupid people following current affairs and believing it so they can go down the pub or down a local bar and say, oh, this is happening, that's happening. And, of course, anybody that's down there who's got a modicum of a decent education and has got a bit more insight into the way the world really works can just raise their eyebrows and say, oh, you don't believe that stuff, do you? Because that's what they want. They want people to disengage. What I do and what you do and many others more are doing now is they do actually watch the mainstream press, so we know what they want us to think and what they decide to tell us, but we've also supplementing our knowledge of the way the world's working by getting quite a lot of information from online sources and sources in the countries where these things are happening, because most countries now, almost every country now is serious, has got its own English language news service. So the Syrian SANA news service, for example, you've got Press TV in Iran, and you know, most of these countries now have got their own English language news service. So that's the place to go to find out what's really going on in that country. And all you need to do sometimes is just to look at, say, Al Jazeera for 5 minutes,
right,
and you'll say, actually, this is what's really going on. And what that does is it enables you to actually follow events much more closely than you would be able to if you were to listen to, say, CNN or the BBC. And it does enable, the internet has enabled intelligent people to actually keep being able to follow events. But very few people, of course, have got the time that we put into it, George, to do that.
Well, you know, RT comes across with some good things, and Al Jazeera at times puts out some good reports. See, you just got to listen to everything and be very careful and discerning about the source.
Well, that's just with this, if you've been following the shooting, mass shooting in Crimea this week, the bomb as well that went off in Crimea. Have you been following that one, George?
I haven't been following closely. I saw the report.
It was quite interesting the way that the even RT changed. I mean, I've noticed one of the RT stories, which I kept a copy of, and I find it extremely disingenuous when news organisations do this, RT or anybody else, is that they actually took a load of words out of the article. One of those was that there were reports of multiple shooters there. In fact, several people had been about multiple shooters. Those initial reports were then extracted from the article, and the article was quietly edited to remove them. So I think we could be looking at a sort of damage limitation exercise by Putin here. He's saying, well, look, we don't want to accuse there of being multiple shooters, because this would actually complicate things diplomatically, even though I think it's extremely unlikely that that Crimea is a random location for a crazed mass shooting and a bomb. Maybe some kid might go a bit crazy with a gun somewhere. I mean, generally they don't, you know, but, and there's usually some kind of intelligence operation behind it. But the fact that it's in Crimea, to me, is a dead giveaway, because Crimea is exactly the area that NATO wants to destabilise, and NATO are exactly the sort of organisation that encourages these mass shootings and bomb attacks, as happened this week. So I think, you know, for me, this is a bit of a wake-up call for... I've never seen RT actually edit their articles before, and then to leave no trace, leave no... I mean, even The Guardian, for God's sake, if they alter one of their articles, they have a little note at the bottom saying, on such and such a time, we removed this from the article. The RT haven't done that. They've just simply done exactly what George Orwell predicted they would do, and they've altered history just within 3 or 4 days of it happening.
Oh, my gosh. You got to be careful, don't you? From day to day, it changes, doesn't it?
Well, that's what they want, yeah? So, you know, if you quite often, I suppose, anyone that's, you know, reading a lot of news and picking up on events around the world will sometimes will say, hang on, I think I remember this slightly different. Is that what happened?
Right.
And the chance of what's happened is the article's either been taken off of Google... the Google algorithm has been altered to remove that article, or else one of the big news organizations has decided they don't want you to know about that anymore, because a lot of this mass media is very, very easy to manipulate, especially big organizations like the BBC, RT, CNN, that have, you know, tens, hundreds of millions of viewers. They can, you know, the temptation is to use it as a tool to control the minds and the perceptions of the masses. And in a way, this is a kind of an insult to millions and millions of people, and they're totally abusing their privilege. A bit like the politician who said, "I'm working for me." You know.
Hey, what about Brexit over there in the UK? What's going on that, Tony?
Oh, Brexit, beautiful Brexit. Well, you know, we've voted for Brexit, although it was interesting over in Holland. I got chatting to a guy near Hook of Holland who was selling fish and chips, and he was a Dutch guy, obviously. He said, my dad always said, because he lived through the war, he didn't fight, his father was a child during World War II, and he said, all the people in The Hague after the war, that is the capital, you know, the government,
right. Okay.
Were on the wrong side during the war.
Oh my gosh.
So the people that sort of took over in the late 40s and early 50s running Holland, many of them had been Nazi collaborators.
Right, yeah.
And he also commented, he said, first thing he said, are you for or against Brexit? He says, I'm confused about this thing. And I said, well, I'm for it. He said, well, you're every British person who's come past here in the last few months I've spoken to and asked about it, they've all been pro-Brexit. Yeah, every night on the TV here in Holland, we see 80% of British people, 85% of British people now want to remain.
I got you. So that's what they're pushing, yeah.
Why are they telling me that? Well, of course, there's a mass propaganda drive going on in order to try and overturn the referendum.
Right, right.
Also, there's a large amount of sabotage from Theresa May. I mean, she's done a load of idiotic things. Well, I mean, they're not idiotic because she always was a Remain voter in the first place. I mean, it's absolutely incredible how you could have a Remain Prime Minister seeing through the process of Brexit. So the parliamentary figures, though, are that there's enough Tories who want... I mean, basically, there's a business point of view which says, a business point of view that says we should be staying in the single market. Now, these, of course, are the globalists. These, of course, are the people who, even though they might not know it, are aligned with this fascist, cartel-dominated EU system, which is what the Nazis wanted to institute during World War II and occupied Europe. You know, that's basically what the EU is. It's a fascist system of cartels running things and no proper elections. I mean, we've got this, the government of Europe, which is the European Commission, the European President, the EU President, Jean-Claude Juncker and his friends, none of them are elected. They're all appointed. And so you have it is impossible for the people of Britain or anywhere else to change who these people are or to get rid of them if they don't like them, because they're all appointees.
Right.
The former Prime Minister of Finland has now been told, because Juncker's term finishes next year, right, not in 2019, we've already been told that the former Prime Minister of Finland is going to be taking over from him. So they've already said, oh, this guy's probably going to be the guy that takes over. You know what he's into? He's into artificial intelligence, he's into robotics, and he attended the Bilderberg conference in 2015.
Right.
So somebody somewhere, a rich and powerful person, a fascist, from the Fascist International, has decided that this person is going to be in charge of running the government of Europe for another 5 years. But in UK here, I mean, there's all sorts of squabbling going on over Brexit. They say no deal would be a disaster. I don't really think it would be such a disaster. One thing's for sure is we really must be leaving the customs union, and we must be leaving the single market. Because if we don't do that, that means that Europe will continue to be setting a lot of our laws to do with what we can and can't trade. You know, the sort of...
Right, trade law, administrative laws.
Standards of products.
Yeah.
They will also be, you know, and this is one of the things that people don't realise, is that the reason that there has been such mass migration is because European law treats people as if they were goods and services. So there's no real difference in law between goods and services being traded around the continent and people being traded around the continent. You know, so that's what the EU has done, is it's turned people into a commodity which is just some ingredient in the economy. And they're not human beings anymore. You know, they're just a number and a few figures on a balance sheet in a profit and loss account. And that's why we want to get out. But whether this will happen, George, I really don't know. Some figures in the House of Commons are that the people who want what they call a hard Brexit, which is getting out of the various currency, the customs union and the single market, which would allow us to then set our own trade policy and that sort of thing and standards of goods and services, and really bring sovereignty back, is in a minority in the House of Commons. So it may actually be that the whole Brexit thing gets put off and put off. And that, of course, is exactly what the Bilderbergers want, and it's exactly what the EU wants. And Theresa May basically has been a kind of Trojan horse. Now, she may be booted out as part of all this, we shall see. But it's very unlikely there'll be a general election, because the Tories would almost certainly lose it. So they won't allow that. But what might well happen is that Theresa May gets replaced by somebody, you know, somebody else in the Tory party. We shall see.
Yeah, Tony, we're at the end of the program. Could you give everyone, our listening audience, connections? And we'll have them up on our site, too. You know, their best, you know, sites, internet sites and stuff. Just give them a little contact information on the air here.
I mean, I was trained by the BBC back in the 1990s, right. Early 1990s. And so what I do is I try and do a public service program. We do that every week, doing what's called the Politics Show, for 2 hours every Friday. And that's on a Friday as people are driving home through the city of Bristol. And so that, you will find that every week, and you'll find a whole load of links, and you can comment on there as well if you want, to stories that have been missed out or misrepresented by the mainstream press, and you can find a whole load of stuff on there. That's at thisweek.org.uk, or you can listen live, and I imagine that's kind of Friday late morning, or lunchtime in the United States.
Yeah, 6 hour difference, it's a 6 hour difference between years.
So that's why. Another website I do, that's thisweek.org.uk, you can listen there. And obviously you can't pick it up on FM over there. So in Texas. So then I also do this thing called the 9/11 Forum, which is numbers 911forum.org.uk, which looks at loads of terrorist attacks. A whole load of people sort of contribute to that. And we look at terror attacks. We also look at assassinations historically. And it's called 9/11, The Bigger Picture and the Quest for Truth, because we see 9/11 and the War on Terror as a total aberration, and we're never going to buy any of the absolute rubbish which is spoken.
Well, you couldn't have said it any better than I could. Thank you very much, Tony Gosling.
Okay, and so that's 911forum.org.uk. God bless, George, okay. And I'll speak to you again soon.
Okay, bless you too. Bye-bye. Good night.